to side, with her cheek resting in her hand. There is silent and long-suffering sorrow to be met with among the peasantry. It withdraws into itself and is still. But there is a grief that breaks out, and from that minute it bursts into tears and finds vent in wailing. This is particularly common with women. But it is no lighter a grief than the silent. Lamentations comfort only by lacerating the heart still more. Such grief does not desire consolation. It feeds on the sense of its hopelessness. Lamentations spring only from the constant craving to reopen the wound.
You are of the tradesman class, said Father Zosima, looking curiously at her.
Town folk we are, Father, town folk. Yet we are peasants, though we live in the town. I've come to see you, O Father. We heard of you, Father, we heard of you. I have buried my little son, and I have come on a pilgrimage. I have been in three monasteries, but they told me, go, Nastasia, go to them. That is to you. I've come, I was yesterday at the service, and today I've come to you.
What are you weeping for?
It's my little son I'm grieving for, Father. He was 3 years old. 3 years, all but 3 months. For my little boy, Father. I'm in anguish for my little boy. He was the last one left. We had four, my Nikita and I, and now we've no children. Our dear ones have all gone. I buried the first three without grieving over much, and now I've buried the last. I can't forget him. He seems always standing before me. He never leaves me. He has withered my heart. I look at his little clothes, his little shirt, his little boots, and I wail. I lay out all that is left of him, all his little things. I look at them and wail. I say to Nikita, my husband, let me go on a pilgrimage, master. He is a driver. We're not poor people, Father, not poor. He drives our own horse. It's all our own, the horse and the carriage. And what good is it all to us now? My Nikita has begun drinking while I'm away, sure to. It used to be so before. As soon as I turn my back, he gives way to it. But now I don't think about him. It's 3 months since I left home. I've forgotten him. I've forgotten everything. I don't want to remember. And what would our life be now together? I've done with him. I've done with them all. I don't care to look upon my house and my goods. I don't care to see anything at all.
Listen, mother, said the elder. Once in olden times a holy saint saw in the temple a mother like you, weeping for her little one, her only one whom God had taken. Knowest thou not, said the saint to her, how bold these little ones are before the throne of God? Verily there are none bolder than they in the kingdom of heaven. Thou didst give us life, O Lord, they say, and scarcely have we looked upon it when thou didst take it back again. And so boldly they ask and ask again that God gives them at once the rank of angels. Therefore, said the saint, thou too, O mother, rejoice and weep not, for thy little one is with the Lord in the fellowship of the angels. That's what the saint said to the weeping mother of old. He was a great saint, and he could not have spoken falsely. Therefore you too, mother, know that your little one is surely before the throne of God, is rejoicing and happy and praying to God for you. And therefore weep, but rejoice.
She became very talkative, kept calling everyone to her, and beckoned to different girls out of the chorus. When the girl came up, she either kissed her or made the sign of the cross over her. In another minute she might have cried. She was greatly amused by the little old man, as she called Maximov. He ran up every minute to kiss her hands, each little finger, and finally he danced another dance to an old song which he sang himself. He danced with special vigour to the refrain. The little pig says, "Mwah, mwah, mwah." The little calf says, "Mwah, mwah, mwah." The little duck says, "Quack, quack, quack."
The little goose says, "Quack, quack, quack." The hen goes strutting through the porch. "Roo, roo, roo," she'll say. "Roo, roo, roo," she'll say.
"Give him something, Mitya," said Grushenka. "Give him a present. He's poor, you know." "Ah, the poor, the insulted. Do you know, Mitya, I shall go into a nunnery. Oh, I really shall one day. Alyosha said something to me today that I shall remember all my life. Yes. But today let us dance. Tomorrow to the nunnery, but today we'll dance. I want to play today, good people, and what of it? God will forgive us. If I were God, I'd forgive everyone. My dear sinners, from this day forth I forgive you. I'm going to beg forgiveness. Forgive me, good people, a silly wench. I'm a beast, that's what I am. But I want to pray. I gave a little onion. Wicked as I've been, I want to pray. Mitya, let them dance. Don't stop them. Everyone in the world is good. Everyone, even the worst of them. The world's a nice place. Though we're bad, the world's all right. We're good and bad, good and bad. Come, tell me, I've something to ask you. Come here, everyone, and I'll ask you. Why am I so good? You know I am good. I'm very good. Come, why am I so good?
So Grushenka babbled on, getting more and more drunk. At last she announced that she was going to dance, too. She got up from her chair, staggering.
Mitya, don't give me any more wine. If I ask you, don't give it to me. Wine doesn't give peace. Everything's going round, the stove and everything. I want to dance. Let everyone see how I dance. Let them see how beautifully I dance.
She really meant it. She pulled a white cambric handkerchief out of her pocket and took it by one corner in her right hand to wave it in the dance. Mitya ran to and fro. The girls were quiet and got ready to break into a dancing song at the first signal. Maximov, hearing that Grushenka wanted to dance, squealed with delight and ran skipping about in front of her humming, "With legs so slim and sides so trim, and its little tail curled tight." But Grushenka waved her handkerchief at him and drove him away.
"Shh, Mitya, why don't they come? Let everyone come to look on. Call them in, too, that were locked in. Why'd you lock them in? Tell them I'm going to dance. Let them look on, too."
Mitya walked with a drunken swagger to the locked door and began knocking to the poles with his fist. "Are you? Podvysotsky's come, she's going to dance, she calls you." "Lydek," one of the poles shouted in reply. "You're a Lydek yourself. You're a little scoundrel, that's what you are."
"Leave off laughing at Poland," said Kalganov sententiously. He too was drunk.
"Be quiet, boy. If I call him a scoundrel, it doesn't mean that I call all Poland so. One Lydek doesn't make a Poland. Be quiet, my pretty boy. Eat a sweetmeat."
"Ach, what fellows, as though they were not men. Why won't they make friends?" said Grushenka, and went forward to dance. The chorus broke into, "Ah, my porch, my new porch."
Grushenka flung back her head, half opened her lips, smiled, waved her handkerchief, and suddenly, with a violent lurch, stood still in the middle of the room, looking bewildered.
I'm weak," she said in an exhausted voice. "Forgive me, I'm weaker. I can't. I'm sorry."
She bowed to the chorus and then began bowing in all directions.
"I'm sorry. Forgive me."
"The lady's been drinking. The pretty lady has been drinking," voices were heard saying. "The lady's drunk too much," Maximov explained to the girls, giggling.
"Mitya, lead me away. Take me," said Grushenka helplessly.
Mitya pounced on her, snatched her up in his arms, and carried the precious burden through the curtains.
"Well, now I'll go," thought Kalganov, and walking out of the blue room, he closed the two halves of the door after him.
But the orgy in the larger room went on and grew louder and louder. Mitya laid Grushenka on the bed and kissed her on the lips.
"Don't touch me,"
she faltered in an imploring voice.
"Don't touch me till I'm yours. I told you I'm yours, but don't touch me. Spare me. With them here, with them close, you mustn't. He's here. It's nasty here."
"I'll obey you. I won't think of it. I worship you," muttered Mitya,
Yes, it's nasty here, it's abominable. And still holding her in his arms, he sank on his knees by the bedside.
I know, though you're a brute, you're generous,
Grushenka articulated with difficulty.
It must be honourable, it shall be honourable for the future, and let us be honest, let us be good, not brutes, but good. Take me away, take me far away, do you hear? I don't want it to be here, but far, far away.
Oh, yes, yes, it must be, said Mitya, pressing her in his arms. I'll take you and we'll fly away. Oh, I'd give my whole life for 1 year only to know about that blood.
What blood?
Asked Grushenka, bewildered. Nothing, muttered Mitya through his teeth. Grusha, you wanted to be honest, but I'm a thief. But I've stolen money from Katya. Disgrace, a disgrace.
From Katya? From that young lady? No, you didn't steal it. Give it her back. Take it from me. Why make a fuss? Now everything of mine is yours. What does money matter? We shall waste it anyway. Folks like us are bound to waste money. But we better go and work the land. I want to dig the earth with my own hands. We must work, do you hear? Alyosha said so. I won't be your mistress, I'll be faithful to you, I'll be your slave. I'll work for you. We'll go to the young lady and bow down to her together, so she may forgive us, and then we'll go away. And if she won't forgive us, we'll go anyway. Take her money and love me. Don't love her. Don't love her any more. If you love her, I shall strangle her. I shall put out both her eyes with a needle.
I love you. I love only you. I'll love you in Siberia.
Why Siberia? Oh, never mind. Siberia, if you like. I don't care. We'll work. The snow in Siberia. I love driving in the snow. I must have bells. Do you hear? There's a bell ringing. Where's that bell ringing? There are people coming. Now it's stopped.
She closed her eyes, exhausted, and suddenly fell asleep for an instant. There had certainly been the sound of a bell in the distance, but the ringing had ceased. Mitya let his head sink on her breast. He did not notice that the bell had ceased ringing, nor did he notice that the songs had ceased, and that instead of singing and drunken clamour, there was absolute stillness in the house. Grushenka opened her eyes.
What's the matter? Was I asleep? Yes, a bell. I've been asleep and dreamt I was driving over the snow with bells, and I dozed. I was with someone I loved, with you. And far, far away, I was holding you and kissing you, nestling close to you. I was cold, and the snow glistened. You know how the snow glistens at night when the moon shines. It was as though I was not on earth. I woke up, and my dear one is close to me. How sweet that is.
Close to you, murmured Mitya, kissing her dress, her bosom, her hands. And suddenly he had a strange fancy. It seemed to him that she was looking straight before her, not at him, not into his face, but over his head with an intent, almost uncanny fixity. An expression of wonder, almost of alarm, came suddenly into her face.
Mitya, who's that, looking at us?
She whispered. Mitya turned and saw that someone had, in fact, parted the curtains and seemed to be watching them. And not one person alone, it seemed. He jumped up and walked quickly to the intruder. Here, come to us. Come here, said a voice, speaking not loudly, but firmly and peremptorily. Mitya passed to the other side of the curtain and stood stock still. The room was filled with people, but not those who had been there before. An instantaneous shiver ran down his back, and he shuddered. He recognized all those people instantly. That tall, stout old man in the overcoat and forage cap with a cockade was the police captain, Mikhail Makarovich, and that consumptive-looking, trim dandy who always has such polished boots. That was the deputy prosecutor. He has a chronometer worth 400 rubles. He showed it to me. And that small young man in spectacles, Mitya forgot his surname, though he knew him, had seen him. He was the investigating lawyer from the School of Jurisprudence, who had only lately come to the town. And this man, the inspector of police, Mavriky Mavrikyevich, a man he knew well. And those fellows with the brass plates on, why are they here? And those other two, peasants. And there at the door, Kalganov with Trifon Borisovich.
"Gentlemen, what's this for, gentlemen?"
began Mitya. But suddenly, as though beside himself, not knowing what he was doing, he cried aloud at the top of his voice,
"I understand."
The young man in spectacles moved forward suddenly, and stepping up to Mitya began with dignity, though hurriedly. "We have to make, in brief, I beg you to come this way to the sofa. It is absolutely imperative that you should give an explanation."
"The old man," cried Mitya frantically, "the old man and his blood, I understand."
And he sank, almost fell, on a chair close by, as though he'd been mown down by a scythe.
"You understand? He understands it, monster and parricide. Your father's blood cries out against you."
The old captain of police roared suddenly, stepping up to Mitya. He was beside himself, crimson in the face and quivering all over.
"This is impossible," cried the small young man. Mihail Makarovich, this won't do. I beg you'll allow me to speak. I should never have expected such behaviour from you." "This is delirium, gentlemen, raving delirium," cried the captain of police. "Look at him, drunk at this time of night, in the company of a disreputable woman with the blood of his father on his hands. It's delirium." "I beg you most earnestly, dear Mihail Makarovich, to restrain your feelings," the prosecutor said in a rapid whisper to the old police captain, "or I shall be forced to resort to—"
But the little lawyer did not allow him to finish. He turned to Mitya and delivered himself in a loud, firm, dignified voice.
"Ex-Lieutenant Karamazov, it is my duty to inform you that you are charged with the murder of your father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, perpetrated this night."
He said something more, and the prosecutor, too, put in something. But though Mitya heard them, he did not understand them. He stared at them all with wild eyes. Part 3. Book 9. The Preliminary Investigation. Chapter 1. The Beginning of Perotin's Official Career. Pyotr Ilyich Perotin, whom we left knocking at the strong, locked gates of the widow Morozov's house, ended, of course, by making himself heard. Fenya, who was still excited by the fright she had had 2 hours before, and too much upset to go to bed, was almost frightened into hysterics on hearing the furious knocking at the gate. Though she had herself seen him drive away, she fancied that it must be Dmitri Fyodorovitch knocking again. No one else could knock so savagely. She ran to the house porter, who had already waked up and gone out to the gate, and began imploring him not to open it. But having questioned Pyotr Ilyich, and learned that he wanted to see Fenya on very important business, the man made up his mind at last to open. Pyotr Ilyich was admitted into Fenya's kitchen, but the girl begged him to allow the house porter to be present, because of her misgivings. He began questioning her, and at once learned the most vital fact, that is, that when Dmitri Fyodorovitch had run out to look for Grushenka, he had snatched up a pestle from the mortar, and that when he returned, the pestle was not with him, and his hands were smeared with blood.
"And the blood was simply flowing, dripping from him, dripping,"
Fenya kept exclaiming. This horrible detail was simply the product of her disordered imagination. But although not dripping, Pyotr Ilyich had himself seen those hands stained with blood and had helped to wash them. Moreover, the question he had to decide was not how soon the blood had dried, but where Dmitri Fyodorovitch had run with the pestle, or rather, whether it really was to Fyodor Pavlovich's, and how he could satisfactorily ascertain. Pyotr Ilyich persisted in returning to this point, and though he found out nothing conclusive, yet he carried away a conviction that Dmitri Fyodorovitch could have gone nowhere but to his father's house, and that therefore something must have happened there.
"And when he came back," Fenya added with excitement, "I told him the whole story, and then I began asking him, 'Why have you got blood on your hands, Dmitri Fyodorovitch?' And he answered that that was human blood and that he'd just killed someone. He confessed it all to me and suddenly ran off like a madman. I sat down and began thinking, 'Where's he run off to now like a madman?' 'He'll go to Mokroe,' I thought, 'and kill my mistress there.' I ran out to beg him not to kill her. I was running to his lodgings, but I looked at Plotnikov's shop and saw him just setting off, and there was no blood on his hands then.
Fenya had noticed this and remembered it. Fenya's old grandmother confirmed her evidence as far as she was capable. After asking some further questions, Pyotr Ilyich left the house, even more upset and uneasy than he had been when he entered it. The most direct and easiest thing for him to do would have been to go straight to Fyodor Pavlovich's to find out whether anything had happened there, and if so, what, and only to go to the police captain, as Pyotr Ilyich firmly intended doing, when he'd satisfied himself of the fact. But the night was dark. Fyodor Pavlovich's gates were strong, and he would have to knock again. His acquaintance with Fyodor Pavlovich was of the slightest, and what if, after he'd been knocking, they opened to him and nothing had happened? And Fyodor Pavlovich, in his jeering way, would go telling the story all over the town, how a stranger, called Perotin, had broken in upon him at midnight to ask if anyone had killed him. It would make a scandal, and scandal was what Pyotr Ilyich dreaded more than anything in the world. Yet the feeling that possessed him was so strong that though he stamped his foot angrily and swore at himself, he set off again, not to Fyodor Pavlovich's, but to Madame Holakov's. He decided that if she denied having just given Dmitri Fyodorovich 3,000 rubles, he would go straight to the police captain, but if she admitted having given him the money, he would go home and let the matter rest till next morning. It is, of course, perfectly evident that there was even more likelihood of causing scandal by going at 11 o'clock at night to a fashionable lady, a complete stranger, and perhaps rousing her from her bed to ask her an amazing question, than by going to Fyodor Pavlovich. But that is just how it is, sometimes, especially in cases like the present one, with the decisions of the most precise and phlegmatic people. Pyotr Ilyich was by no means phlegmatic at that moment. He remembered all his life how a haunting uneasiness gradually gained possession of him, growing more and more painful and driving him on against his will. Yet he kept cursing himself, of course, all the way for going to this lady, but, "I will get to the bottom of it, I will," he repeated for the 10th time, grinding his teeth, and he carried out his intention. It was exactly 11 o'clock when he entered Madame Holakov's house. He was admitted into the yard pretty quickly, but in response to his inquiry whether the lady was still up, the porter could give no answer, except that she was usually in bed by that time. "Ask at the top of the stairs. If the lady wants to receive you, she'll receive you. If she won't, she won't." Pyotr Ilyich went up, but did not find things so easy here. The footman was unwilling to take in his name, but finally called a maid. Pyotr Ilyich politely but insistently begged her to inform her lady that an official living in the town, called Perotin, had called on particular business, and that if it were not of the greatest importance, he would not have ventured to come. "Tell her in those words exactly," he asked the girl. She went away. He remained, waiting in the entry. Madame Holakov herself was already in her bedroom, though not yet asleep. She had felt upset ever since Mitya's visit, and had a presentiment that she would not get through the night without the sick headache which always, with her, followed such excitement. She was surprised on hearing the announcement from the maid. She irritably declined to see him, however, though the unexpected visit at such an hour of an official living in the town, who was a total stranger, roused her feminine curiosity intensely. But this time Pyotr Ilyich was as obstinate as a mule. He begged the maid most earnestly to take another message in these very words, that he had come on business of the greatest importance, and that Madame Holakov might have cause to regret it later if she refused to see him now. "I plunged headlong," he described it afterwards. The maid, gazing at him in amazement, went to take his message again. Madame Holakov was impressed. She thought a little, asked what he looked like, and learned that he was very well dressed, young, and so polite. We may note, parenthetically, that Pyotr Ilyich was a rather good-looking young man, and well aware of the fact. Madame Holakov made up her mind to see him. She was in her dressing-gown and slippers, but she flung a black shawl over her shoulders. The official was asked to walk into the drawing-room, the very room in which Mitya had been received shortly before. The lady came to meet her visitor with a sternly inquiring countenance, and without asking him to sit down, began at once with the question, "What do you want?" "I venture to disturb you, madame, on a matter concerning our common acquaintance, Dmitri Fyodorovich Karamazov," Perotin began. But he'd hardly uttered the name when the lady's face showed signs of acute irritation. She almost shrieked, and interrupted him in a fury. "How much longer am I to be worried by that awful man?" she cried hysterically. "How dare you, sir? How could you venture to disturb a lady who is estranged to you in her own house at such an hour, and to force yourself upon her to talk of a man who came here, to this very drawing-room, only 3 hours ago, to murder me, and went stamping out of the room, as no one would go out of a decent house? Let me tell you, sir, that I shall lodge a complaint against you, that I will not let it pass. Kindly leave me at once. I am a mother. Murder? Then he tried to murder you, too? Why, has he killed somebody else?" Madame Holokov asked impulsively. "If you would kindly listen, madame, for half a moment, I'll explain it all in a couple of words," answered Perotin firmly. "At 5 o'clock this afternoon, Dmitri Fyodorovich borrowed 10 rubles from me, and I know for a fact he had no money. Yet at 9 o'clock he came to see me with a bundle of 100-ruble notes in his hand, about 2,000 or 3,000 rubles. His hands and face were all covered with blood, and he looked like a madman. When I asked him where he'd got so much money, he answered that he'd just received it from you, that you had given him a sum of 3,000 to go to the gold mines." Madame Holokov's face assumed an expression of intense and painful excitement. "Good God, he must have killed his own father," she cried, clasping her hands. "I've never given him money, never. Oh, run, run, don't say another word. Save the old man, run to his father, run." "Excuse me, madame, then you did not give him money? You remember for a fact that you did not give him any money?" "No, I didn't. I refused to give it to him, for he could not appreciate it. He ran out in a fury, stamping. He rushed at me, but I slipped away. And let me tell you, as I wish to hide nothing from you now, that he positively spat at me. Can you fancy that? But why are we standing? Ah, sit down. Excuse me, better, run, run. You must run and save the poor old man from an awful death." "But if he's killed him already..." "Oh, good heavens, yes, then what are we to do now? What do you think we must do now?" Meantime, she'd made Pyotr Ilyich sit down and sat down herself facing him. Briefly, but fairly clearly, Pyotr Ilyich told her the history of the affair, that part of it at least which he had himself witnessed. He described, too, his visit to Fenya, and told her about the pestle. All these details produced an overwhelming effect on the distracted lady, who kept uttering shrieks and covering her face with her hands. "Would you believe it? I foresaw all this. I have that special faculty. Whatever I imagine comes to pass, and how often I've looked at that awful man and always thought that man will end by murdering me. And now it's happened. That is, if he hasn't murdered me, but only his own father. It's only because the finger of God preserved me, and what's more, he was ashamed to murder me, because on this very place I put the holy icon from the relics of the holy martyr Saint Varvara on his neck. And to think how near I was to death at that minute. I went close up to him, and he stretched out his neck to me. Do you know, Pyotr Ilyich, I think you said your name was Pyotr Ilyich, I don't believe in miracles, but that icon and this unmistakable miracle with me now, that shakes me, and I'm ready to believe in anything you like. Have you heard about Father Zosima? But I don't know what I'm saying. And only fancy, with the icon on his neck, he spat at me. He only spat, it's true, he didn't murder me, and he dashed away. What shall we do? What must we do now? What do you think? Pyotr Ilyich got up and announced that he was going straight to the police captain to tell him all about it, and leave him to do what he thought fit. "Oh, he's an excellent man, excellent. Mikhail Makarovich, I know him, of course, he's the person to go to. How practical you are, Pyotr Ilyich. How well you've thought of everything. I should never have thought of it in your place." "Especially as I know the police captain very well, too," observed Pyotr Ilyich, who still continued to stand, and was obviously anxious to escape as quickly as possible from the impulsive lady, who would not let him say good-bye and go away. "And be sure," she prattled on, "to come back and tell me what you see there and what you find out, what comes to light, how they'll try him, and what he's condemned to. Tell me, we have no capital punishment, have we? Be sure to come, even if it's at 3 o'clock at night, but at four, at 4:30. Tell him to wake me, to shake me if I don't get up. Good heavens, I shan't sleep. But wait, hadn't I better come with you?" No. But if you would write 3 lines with your own hand stating that you did not give Dmitri Fyodorovich money, it might perhaps be of use.
in case it's needed. To be sure, Madame Holokov skipped, delighted, to her bureau. And you know, I'm simply struck, amazed at your resourcefulness, your good sense in such affairs. Are you in the service here? I'm delighted to think that you're in the service here.
And still speaking, she scribbled on half a sheet of notepaper the following lines.
I've never in my life lent to that unhappy man, Dmitri Fyodorovich Karamazov, for in spite of all he is unhappy, 3,000 rubles today. I've never given him money, never. That I swear by all that's holy. K. Holokov. Here's the note. She turned quickly to Pyotr Ilyich. Go, save him. It's a noble deed on your part.
And she made the sign of the cross 3 times over him. She ran out to accompany him to the passage.
How grateful I am to you. You can't think how grateful I am to you for having come to me first. How is it I haven't met you before? I shall feel flattered at seeing you at my house in the future. How delightful it is that you're living here. Such precision, such practical ability. They must appreciate you. They must understand you. If there's anything I can do, believe me. Oh, I love young people. I'm in love with young people. The young generation are the one prop of our suffering country, her one hope. Oh, go, go.
But Pyotr Ilyich had already run away, or she would not have let him go so soon. Yet Madame Holokov had made a rather agreeable impression on him, which had somewhat softened his anxiety at being drawn into such an unpleasant affair.
Tastes differ, as we all know. She's by no means so elderly, he thought, feeling pleased. On the contrary, I should have taken her for her daughter.
As for Madame Holokov, she was simply enchanted by the young man.
Such sense, such exactness in so young a man, in our day, and all that with such manners and appearance. People say the young people of today are no good for anything, but here's an example,
etc., etc. So she simply forgot this dreadful affair. And it was only as she was getting into bed that, suddenly recalling how near death she'd been, she exclaimed,
"Ah, it is awful, awful!"
But she fell at once into a sound, sweet sleep. I would not, however, have dwelt on such trivial and irrelevant details if this eccentric meeting of the young official with the by no means elderly widow had not subsequently turned out to be the foundation of the whole career of that practical and precise young man. His story is remembered to this day with amazement in our town, and I shall perhaps have something to say about it when I have finished my long history of the brothers Karamazov. Chapter 2. The Alarm. Our police captain, Mikhail Makarovich Makarov, a retired lieutenant colonel, was a widower and an excellent man. He'd only come to us 3 years previously, but had won general esteem, chiefly because he knew how to keep society together. He was never without visitors, and could not have got on without them. Someone or other was always dining with him. He never sat down to table without guests. He gave regular dinners, too, on all sorts of occasions, sometimes most surprising ones. Though the fare was not recherché, it was abundant. The fish pies were excellent, and the wine made up in quantity for what it lacked in quality. The first room his guests entered was a well-fitted billiard room, with pictures of English racehorses in black frames on the walls, an essential decoration, as we all know, for a bachelor's billiard room. There was card playing every evening at his house, if only at one table. But at frequent intervals, all the society of our town, with the mamas and young ladies, assembled at his house to dance. Though Mikhail Makarovich was a widower, he did not live alone. His widowed daughter lived with him, with her 2 unmarried daughters, grown-up girls, who had finished their education. They were of agreeable appearance and lively character, and though everyone knew they would have no dowry, they attracted all the young men of fashion to their grandfather's house. Mikhail Makarovich was by no means very efficient in his work, though he performed his duties no worse than many others. To speak plainly, he was a man of rather narrow education. His understanding of the limits of his administrative power could not always be relied upon. It was not so much that he failed to grasp certain reforms enacted during the present reign, as that he made conspicuous blunders in his interpretation of them. This was not from any special lack of intelligence, but from carelessness, for he was always in too great a hurry to go into the subject. "I have the heart of a soldier rather than of a civilian," he used to say of himself.
He had not even formed a definite idea of the fundamental principles of the reforms connected with the emancipation of the serfs, and only picked it up, so to speak, from year to year, involuntarily increasing his knowledge by practice. And yet he was himself a landowner. Pyotr Ilyich knew for certain that he would meet some of Mikhail Makarovich's visitors there that evening, but he didn't know which. As it happened, at that moment the prosecutor and Varvinsky, our district doctor, a young man who had only just come to us from Petersburg after taking a brilliant degree at the Academy of Medicine, were playing whist at the police captain's. Ippolit Kirillovich, the prosecutor, he was really the deputy prosecutor, but we always called him the prosecutor, was rather a peculiar man of about 35, inclined to be consumptive, and married to a fat and childless woman. He was vain and irritable, though he had a good intellect and even a kind heart. It seemed that all that was wrong with him was that he had a better opinion of himself than his ability warranted, and that made him seem constantly uneasy. He had, moreover, certain higher, even artistic, leanings towards psychology, for instance, a special study of the human heart, a special knowledge of the criminal and his crime. He cherished a grievance on this ground, considering that he'd been passed over in the service, and being firmly persuaded that in higher spheres he had not been properly appreciated, and had enemies. In gloomy moments he even threatened to give up his post and practice as a barrister in criminal cases. The unexpected Karamazov case agitated him profoundly. It was a case that might well be talked about all over Russia. But I am anticipating. Nikolai Parfenovich Nelyudov, the young investigating lawyer, who had only come from Petersburg 2 months before, was sitting in the next room with the young ladies. People talked about it afterwards and wondered that all the gentlemen should, as though intentionally, on the evening of the crime, have been gathered together at the house of the executive authority. Yet it was perfectly simple and happened quite naturally. Ippolit Kirillovich's wife had had toothache for the last 2 days, and he was obliged to go out to escape from her groans. The doctor, from the very nature of his being, could not spend an evening except at cards. Nikolai Parfenovich Nelyudov had been intending for 3 days past to drop in that evening at Mikhail Makarovich's, so to speak casually, so as slyly to startle the eldest granddaughter, Olga Mikhailovna, by showing that he knew her secret, that he knew it was her birthday, and that she was trying to conceal it on purpose, so as not to be obliged to give a dance. He anticipated a great deal of merriment, many playful jests about her age, and her being afraid to reveal it, about his knowing her secret and telling everybody, and so on. The charming young man was a great adept at such teasing. The ladies had christened him the Naughty Man, and he seemed to be delighted at the name. He was extremely well-bred, however, of good family, education, and feelings, and though leading a life of pleasure, his sallies were always innocent and in good taste. He was short and delicate-looking. On his white, slender little fingers, he always wore a number of big, glittering rings. When he was engaged in his official duties, he always became extraordinarily grave, as though realizing his position and the sanctity of the obligations laid upon him. He had a special gift for mystifying murderers and other criminals of the peasant class during interrogation, and if he did not win their respect, he certainly succeeded in arousing their wonder. Pyotr Ilyich was simply dumbfounded when he went into the police captain's. He saw instantly that everyone knew. They'd positively thrown down their cards, or were standing up and talking. Even Nikolai Parfenovich had left the young ladies and ran in, looking strenuous and ready for action. Pyotr Ilyich was met with the astounding news that old Fyodor Pavlovich really had been murdered that evening in his own house. Murdered and robbed. The news had only just reached them in the following manner. Marfa Ignatyevna, the wife of old Grigory, who had been knocked senseless near the fence, was sleeping soundly in her bed, and might well have slept till morning, after the draught she'd taken. But all of a sudden she waked up, no doubt roused by a fearful epileptic scream from Smerdyakov, who was lying in the next room unconscious. That scream always preceded his fits, and always terrified and upset Marfa Ignatievna. She could never get accustomed to it. She jumped up and ran, half awake, to Smerdyakov's room. But it was dark there, and she could only hear the invalid beginning to gasp and struggle. Then Marfa Ignatievna herself screamed out and was going to call her husband, but suddenly realized that when she got up he was not beside her in bed. She ran back to the bedstead and began groping with her hands, but the bed was really empty. Then he must have gone out. Where? She ran to the steps and timidly called him. She got no answer, of course, but she caught the sound of groans far away in the garden in the darkness. She listened. The groans were repeated, and it was evident that they came from the garden.
Good Lord, just as it was with Lizaveta Smerdyashchaya, she thought distractedly.
She went timidly down the steps and saw that the gate into the garden was open.
He must be out there, poor dear, she thought.
She went up to the gate, and all at once she distinctly heard Grigory calling her by name.
Marfa! Marfa!
In a weak, moaning, dreadful voice.
Lord, preserve us from harm!
Marfa Ignatievna murmured, and ran towards the voice, and that was how she found Grigory. But she found him not by the fence where he'd been knocked down, but about 20 paces off. It appeared later that he'd crawled away on coming to himself, and probably had been a long time getting so far, losing consciousness several times. She noticed at once that he was covered with blood, and screamed at the top of her voice. Grigory was muttering incoherently.
He has murdered! His father murdered! Why scream, silly? Run! Fetch someone!
But Marfa continued screaming, and seeing that her master's window was open, and that there was a candle alight in the window, she ran there and began calling Fyodor Pavlovich. But peeping into the window, she saw a fearful sight. Her master was lying on his back, motionless, on the floor. His light-coloured dressing gown and white shirt were soaked with blood. The candle on the table brightly lighted up the blood and the motionless, dead face of Fyodor Pavlovich. Terror-stricken, Marfa rushed away from the window, ran out of the garden, drew the bolt of the big gate, and ran headlong by the back way to the neighbour, Maria Kondratievna. Both mother and daughter were asleep, but they waked up at Marfa's desperate and persistent screaming and knocking at the shutter. Marfa, shrieking and screaming incoherently, managed to tell them the main fact, and to beg for assistance. It happened that Foma had come back from his wanderings and was staying the night with them. They got him up immediately, and all three ran to the scene of the crime. On the way, Maria Kondratievna remembered that at about 8 o'clock she heard a dreadful scream from their garden, and this was no doubt Grigory's scream, parricide, uttered when he caught hold of Mitya's leg.
"Some one person screamed out and then was silent," Maria Kondratievna explained as she ran.
Running to the place where Grigory lay, the two women, with the help of Foma, carried him to the lodge. They lighted a candle, and saw that Smerdyakov was no better, that he was writhing in convulsions, his eyes fixed in a squint, and that foam was flowing from his lips. They moistened Grigory's forehead with water mixed with vinegar, and the water revived him at once. He asked immediately,
"Is the master murdered?"
Then Foma and both the women ran to the house and saw this time that not only the window, but also the door into the garden was wide open, though Fyodor Pavlovich had for the last week locked himself in every night and did not allow even Grigory to come in on any pretext. Seeing that door open, they were afraid to go in to Fyodor Pavlovich for fear anything should happen afterwards. And when they returned to Grigory, the old man told them to go straight to the police captain. Maria Kondratievna ran there and gave the alarm to the whole party at the police captain's. She arrived only 5 minutes before Pyotr Ilyich, so that his story came not as his own surmise and theory, but as the direct confirmation, by a witness, of the theory held by all as to the identity of the criminal, a theory he had in the bottom of his heart refused to believe till that moment. It was resolved to act with energy. The deputy police inspector of the town was commissioned to take 4 witnesses, to enter Fyodor Pavlovich's house, and there to open an inquiry on the spot, according to the regular forms, which I will not go into here. The district doctor, a zealous man, new to his work,
almost insisted on accompanying the police captain, the prosecutor, and the investigating lawyer. I will note briefly that Fyodor Pavlovich was found to be quite dead, with his skull battered in. But with what? Most likely with the same weapon with which Grigory had been attacked later. And immediately that weapon was found, Grigory, to whom all possible medical assistance was at once given, described in a weak and breaking voice how he'd been knocked down. They began looking with a lantern by the fence, and found the brass pestle dropped in a most conspicuous place on the garden path. There were no signs of disturbance in the room where Fyodor Pavlovich was lying. But by the bed, behind the screen, they picked up from the floor a big and thick envelope with the inscription, "A present of 3,000 rubles for my angel Grushenka, if she is willing to come." And below had been added by Fyodor Pavlovich, "For my little chicken." There were three seals of red sealing wax on the envelope, but it had been torn open and was empty. The money had been removed. They found also on the floor a piece of narrow pink ribbon with which the envelope had been tied up. One piece of Pyotr Ilyich's evidence made a great impression on the prosecutor and the investigating magistrate, namely, his idea that Dmitri Fyodorovich would shoot himself before daybreak, that he'd resolved to do so, had spoken of it to Pyotr Ilyich, had taken the pistols, loaded them before him, written a letter, put it in his pocket, etc. When Pyotr Ilyich, though still unwilling to believe it, threatened to tell someone so as to prevent the suicide, Mitya had answered, grinning, "You'll be too late." So they must make haste to Mokroe to find the criminal before he really did shoot himself. "That's clear, that's clear," repeated the prosecutor in great excitement. "That's just the way with mad fellows like that. I shall kill myself tomorrow, so I'll make merry till I die." The story of how he'd bought the wine and provisions excited the prosecutor more than ever. "Do you remember the fellow that murdered a merchant called Al-Sufiev, gentlemen? He stole 1,500, went at once to have his hair curled, and then, without even hiding the money, carrying it almost in his hand, in the same way he went off to the girls." All were delayed, however, by the inquiry, the search, and the formalities, etc., in the house of Fyodor Pavlovich. It all took time, and so, 2 hours before starting, they sent on ahead to Mokroe the officer of the rural police, Mavriky Mavrikyevich Shmertsov, who'd arrived in the town the morning before to get his pay. He was instructed to avoid raising the alarm when he reached Mokroe, but to keep constant watch over the criminal till the arrival of the proper authorities, to procure also witnesses for the arrest, police constables, and so on. Mavriky Mavrikyevich did as he was told, preserving his incognito and giving no one but his old acquaintance, Trifon Borisovich, the slightest hint of his secret business. He had spoken to him just before Mitya met the landlord in the balcony, looking for him in the dark, and noticed at once a change in Trifon Borisovich's face and voice. So neither Mitya nor anyone else knew that he was being watched. The box with the pistols had been carried off by Trifon Borisovich and put in a suitable place. Only after 4 o'clock, almost at sunrise, all the officials, the police captain, the prosecutor, the investigating lawyer, drove up in 2 carriages, each drawn by 3 horses. The doctor remained at Fyodor Pavlovich's to make a post-mortem next day on the body, but he was particularly interested in the condition of the servant, Smerdyakov. "Such violent and protracted epileptic fits, recurring continually for 24 hours, are rarely to be met with, and are of interest to science," he declared enthusiastically to his companions, and as they left they laughingly congratulated him on his find. The prosecutor and the investigating lawyer distinctly remembered the doctors saying that Smerdyakov could not outlive the night. After these long, but I think necessary, explanations, we will return to that moment of our tale at which we broke off. Chapter 3. The Sufferings of a Soul, the First Ordeal. And so Mitya sat looking wildly at the people round him, not understanding what was said to him. Suddenly he got up, flung up his hands, and shouted aloud, "I'm not guilty! I'm not guilty of that blood! I'm not guilty of my father's blood! I meant to kill him, but I'm not guilty, not I!" But he'd hardly said this before Grushenka rushed from behind the curtain and flung herself at the police captain's feet. "It was my fault, mine, my wickedness!" she cried in a heart-rending voice, bathed in tears, stretching out her clasped hands towards them.
He did it through me. I tortured him and drove him to it. I tortured that poor old man that's dead, too, in my wickedness, and brought him to this. It's my fault. Mine first, mine most, my fault.
Yes, it's your fault. You're the chief criminal. You fury, you harlot, you're the most to blame,
shouted the police captain, threatening her with his hand. But he was quickly and resolutely suppressed. The prosecutor positively seized hold of him.
This is absolutely irregular, Mikhail Makarovich, he cried. You are positively hindering the inquiry. You are ruining the case.
He almost gasped.
Follow the regular course. Follow the regular course,
cried Nikolai Parfenovich, fearfully excited too.
Otherwise, it's absolutely impossible.
Judge us together, Grushenka cried frantically, still kneeling. Punish us together. I will go with him now, if it's to death.
Grusha, my life, my blood, my holy one.
Mitya fell on his knees beside her and held her tight in his arms.
Don't believe her, he cried. She's not guilty of anything, of any blood, of anything.
He remembered afterwards that he was forcibly dragged away from her by several men, and that she was led out, and that when he recovered himself he was sitting at the table. Beside him and behind him stood the men with metal plates. Facing him on the other side of the table sat Nikolai Parfenovich, the investigating lawyer. He kept persuading him to drink a little water out of a glass that stood on the table.
That will refresh you, that will calm you. Be calm, don't be frightened,
he added extremely politely. Mitya, he remembered it afterwards, became suddenly intensely interested in his big rings, one with an amethyst and another with a transparent bright yellow stone of great brilliance. And long afterwards he remembered with wonder how those rings had riveted his attention through all those terrible hours of interrogation, so that he was utterly unable to tear himself away from them and dismiss them as things that had nothing to do with his position. On Mitya's left side, in the place where Maximov had been sitting at the beginning of the evening, the prosecutor was now seated, and on Mitya's right hand, where Grushenka had been, was a rosy-cheeked young man in a sort of shabby hunting jacket, with ink and paper before him. This was the secretary of the investigating lawyer, who had brought him with him. The police captain was now standing by the window at the other end of the room, beside Kalganov, who was sitting there.
"Drink some water," said the investigating lawyer softly for the tenth time.
"I've drunk it, gentlemen, I have. But come, gentlemen, crush me, punish me, decide my fate,"
cried Mitya, staring with terribly fixed, wide-open eyes at the investigating lawyer.
"So you positively declare that you are not guilty of the death of your father, Fyodor Pavlovich?"
asked the investigating lawyer, softly but insistently.
"I'm not guilty. I am guilty of the blood of another old man, but not of my father's, and I weep for it. I killed the old man and knocked him down, but it's hard to have to answer for that murder with another, a terrible murder of which I'm not guilty. It's a terrible accusation, gentlemen, a knock-down blow. But who has killed my father? Who has killed him? Who can have killed him if I didn't? It's marvellous, extraordinary, impossible."
"Yes, who can have killed him?"
the investigating lawyer was beginning, but Ippolit Kirillovich, the prosecutor, glancing at him, addressed Mitya.
"You need not worry yourself about the old servant, Grigory Vasilievich. He is alive, he has recovered, and in spite of the terrible blows inflicted, according to his own and your evidence, by you, there seems no doubt that he will live, so the doctor says, at least."
"Alive! He's alive!"
cried Mitya, flinging up his hands. His face beamed.
"Lord, I thank thee for the miracle thou hast wrought for me, a sinner and evildoer. That's an answer to my prayer I've been praying all night."
And he crossed himself three times. He was almost breathless.
"So from this Grigory we have received such important evidence concerning you that—"
the prosecutor would have continued, but Mitya suddenly jumped up from his chair.
"One minute, gentlemen, for God's sake, 1 minute. I'll run to her. Excuse me at this moment, it's quite impossible,"
Nikolai Parfenovich almost shrieked. He too leapt to his feet. Mitya was seized by the men with the metal plates, but he sat down on his own accord.
"Gentlemen, what a pity. I wanted to see her for 1 minute only. I wanted to tell her that it has been washed away, it has gone, that blood that was weighing on my heart all night, and that I'm not a murderer now. Gentlemen, she is my betrothed,"
he said, ecstatically and reverently looking round at them all.
"Oh, thank you, gentlemen. Oh, in 1 minute you have given me new life, new heart.
That old man used to carry me in his arms, gentlemen. He used to wash me in the tub when I was a baby, 3 years old, abandoned by everyone. He was like a father to me.
And so you, the investigating lawyer began.
Allow me, gentlemen, allow me 1 minute more, interposed Mitya, putting his elbows on the table and covering his face with his hands. Let me have a moment to think. Let me breathe, gentlemen. All this is horribly upsetting, horribly. A man is not a drum, gentlemen.
Drink a little more water, murmured Nikolai Parfenovich. Mitya took his hands from his face and laughed. His eyes were confident. He seemed completely transformed in a moment. His whole bearing was changed. He was once more the equal of these men with all of whom he was acquainted, as though they'd all met the day before when nothing had happened at some social gathering. We may note in passing that on his first arrival, Mitya had been made very welcome at the police captain's, but later, during the last month especially, Mitya had hardly called at all. And when the police captain met him in the street, for instance, Mitya noticed that he frowned and only bowed out of politeness. His acquaintance with the prosecutor was less intimate, though he sometimes paid his wife, a nervous and fanciful lady, visits of politeness, without quite knowing why, and she always received him graciously, and had for some reason taken an interest in him up to the last. He had not had time to get to know the investigating lawyer, though he had met him and talked to him twice, each time about the fair sex.
"You're a most skilful lawyer, I see, Nikolai Parfenovich," cried Mitya, laughing gaily. "But I can help you now. Oh, gentlemen, I feel like a new man, and don't be offended at my addressing you so simply and directly. I'm rather drunk, too, I'll tell you that frankly. I believe I've had the honour and pleasure of meeting you, Nikolai Parfenovich, at my kinsman Musov's. Gentlemen, gentlemen, I don't pretend to be on equal terms with you. I understand, of course, in what character I'm sitting before you. Oh, of course, there's a horrible suspicion hanging over me. If Gregory has given evidence, a horrible suspicion. It's awful, awful. I understand that. But to business, gentlemen, I am ready, and we will make an end of it in one moment. But listen, listen, gentlemen, since I know I'm innocent, we can put an end to it in a minute, can't we? Can't we?"
Mitya spoke much and quickly, nervously and effusively, as though he positively took his listeners to be his best friends. "So for the present, we will write that you absolutely deny this charge brought against you," said Nikolai Parfenovich impressively, and bending down to the secretary, he dictated to him in an undertone what to write.
"Write it down? You want to write that down? Well, write it. I consent. I give my full consent, gentlemen. Only, do you see... Stay, write this. Of disorderly conduct, I am guilty. Of violence on a poor old man, I am guilty. And there is something else at the bottom of my heart of which I am guilty too. But that you need not write down."
He turned suddenly to the secretary.
"That's my personal life, gentlemen. That doesn't concern you. The bottom of my heart, that's to say... But of the murder of my old father, I'm not guilty. That's a wild idea. It's quite a wild idea. I'll prove you that, and you'll be convinced directly. You'll laugh, gentlemen, you'll laugh yourself at your suspicion."
"Be calm, Dmitri Fyodorovitch," said the investigating lawyer, evidently trying to allay Mitya's excitement by his own composure. "Before we go on with our inquiry, I should like, if you will consent to answer, to hear you confirm the statement that you disliked your father, Fyodor Pavlovich, that you were involved in continual disputes with him. Here, at least, a quarter of an hour ago, you exclaimed that you wanted to kill him."
"I didn't kill him, you said, but I wanted to kill him." "Did I exclaim that? Oh, that may be so, gentlemen, yes. Unhappily, I did want to kill him. Many times I wanted to. Unhappily, unhappily."
"You wanted to. Would you consent to explain what motives precisely led you to such a sentiment of hatred for your parent?"
"What is there to explain, gentlemen?"
Mitya shrugged his shoulders sullenly, looking down.
"I've never concealed my feelings. All the town knows about it. Everyone knows in the tavern. Only lately I declared them in Father Zosima's cell. And the very same day, in the evening, I beat my father. I nearly killed him, and I swore I'd come again and kill him before witnesses. Oh, 1,000 witnesses. I've been shouting aloud for the last month. Anyone can tell you that. The fact stares you in the face. It speaks for itself. It cries aloud. But feelings, gentlemen, feelings are another matter. You see, gentlemen..."
Mitya frowned.
"It seems to me that about feelings you've no right to question me. I know that you are bound by your office, I quite understand that. But that's my affair, my private, intimate affair. Yet,
since I haven't concealed my feelings in the past. In the tavern, for instance, I've talked to everyone, so I won't make a secret of it now. You see, I understand, gentlemen, that there are terrible facts against me in this business. I told everyone that I'd kill him, and now, all of a sudden, he's been killed. So it must have been me. I can't.